It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon, I'm Batya Bricker and you're listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. There are books we read, and then there are books we travel through. Today's show is about books that don't just tell you a story, but take you somewhere. Not metaphorically, not vaguely, but sensorily, almost tangibly. It's the kind of fiction where you can feel the grit of desert sand between your fingers, taste the salt of a faraway sea, and hear the hum of a city you've never visited. Transportative fiction is not just about place, although place matters. It's about atmosphere, about immersion, about the writer's ability to build a world so complete that you don't just observe it, but you actually inhabit it. You step into other lives, other landscapes, other histories, and you become, for a few pages, someone else entirely. It's this kind of fiction that feeds your wanderlust. I know it does mine. But also your empathy, your curiosity, your sense of wonder. And so today we are setting off. There's no passport required, no visa required, no packing necessary, just through the pages of books that take you places. And I'd love to know, have you had a book that has taken you somewhere so vividly that you felt you had been there? Send me your thoughts on the WhatsApp line 061-895-1019. So as we begin our magic carpet ride to four different places on the globe, I'm going to begin in southern USA, in Mississippi, with the new book by Catherine Stockett, The Calamity Club. We've waited over 15 years for this book. You may remember The Help. It was published in 2009, and it was such a huge hit. It was about African Americans working in white households in Jackson, Mississippi. And Catherine, it was during the 60s, but Catherine herself was born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi. So you can feel her lived experience on every page. And she has brought that sense of texture and color to The Calamity Club. It offers the same evocative, immersive experience. So this is 1933, Oxford, Mississippi. Prohibition is on the wane, and the Great Depression is tightening its grip. Poor and rich folk alike have fallen on hard times, even as social order remains. And for women on the margins, the options are few, and the price of dignity and self-determination is unbearably high. You are going to meet a host of colorful characters. There's 11-year-old Meg, one of the unadoptable big girls of the Lafayette County Orphan Asylum. She fights each day to keep her spirit unbowed. There's Birdie, unmarried and outspoken, who's come to Oxford on a mission to ask her social climbing sister to help a struggling family that she left behind when she was climbing that social ladder. And there's Charlie, with a past, running low on luck but driven by fire, fury, and grit. And while their fates converge, they come up with the most audacious plan to take back control of their lives.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker. And today we are talking about books that take you places, transport you to a different place or time. The book we're talking about is Catherine Stockett's The Calamity Club, and there is so much I want to say about this book, but I do risk spoiling the storyline, and of course we know spoilers are not allowed. So I will just say this, that The Calamity Club will make you laugh, it will make you cry and cheer. It's an epic testament to resilience and friendship and the fierce, funny woman who know that calamity can be the spark of new things. It is Catherine Stockett at her most confident, heartfelt, and hilarious. My only criticism is that it is 600 pages long, which means that the story has to sustain the reader for a long time. The reviewers that I'm seeing are saying the same thing, that it perhaps dragged a little bit in the middle, but it's so completely immersive, and there's no ways you're going to abandon the story halfway. You will want to read to the end, and it does keep you going. I totally loved it. Let me introduce you to Birdie, just to give you a sense of the depth of characters and how colorful they really are. The story of Birdie, this book, in as much as it's a story about many women, but it really is also a story of her coming of age. And you can almost hear her southern drawl on you know, anything that you read about her. So let me start with her. It's September 1933, and it's Birdie introducing herself. Downtown drugstore had a bell on the door that made a single tink sound when you opened it. Oxford Pharmacy had two bells on its door, so it was more of a ta-tink, though nothing to startle over. But the Garthright Reed Drug Company door bore a foot-long strip of brass sleigh bells on its knob, which, when turned, sent metal balls clanging to announce somebody's arrival in the dang store. So you better turn around and look and see who it is. And if you did, you'd see me. At the pay counter to my right, a heavy woman was buying something prep, the noisiest of my sister Frances's many friends. Her blonde hair bobbed left and right and then down on this humid September morning. Birdie, I haven't seen you in a while, she said. She was paying for a pair of rayons, sized, I'm sure, extra, you know it all. Hey, Prep, I said, and kept walking straight on past her. I went to the back of the store and stood myself behind the most human-sized rack I could find and picked up whatever was close. It was a tin of men's Brill cream, and I held it close to my head, hoping that it would make me less talkable too. What the heck do I have? Why the heck do I have to do this? And at the store, on the square, no less, when all the other girls get to go to the other side of town to buy bed sheets or race records. Deep down, I knew perfectly well why. Because no one would ever suspect me of such a thing. I was Birdie Calhoun, 24 years old, churchy and chinless, kind to all animals and people. I'd never do anything close to what I was actually doing. If you love big-hearted historical novels about strong women banding together in tough times, then this is worth the read. Another big-hearted book that I really loved is called A Far-Flung Life by M.L. Stedman, and it takes us to Western Australia. Her first novel was The Light Between Oceans, and you may remember it, but it was a long time ago. It was published a good 12, 15 years ago. It won numerous awards. It was set in World War I Australia, the unforgettable story of a lighthouse keeper and his wife who raise a baby that they find adrift only to face the consequences of their choices. We've waited a good long time for M.L. Stedman to write her next book, but I can tell you that it was worth the wait. A Far-Flung Life is a breathtaking and epic novel set in the outback of Australia about tragedy, family secrets, the aftermath that reverberates for decades, and the power of love. When we do something that can't be undone or mended, how do we go about living? How do we find a North Star when there really is no right answer? So the story is in remote Western Australia, 1958, and here for generations, the McBrides have lived on a vast sheep station, Meredith Downs. It's a million acres, it's an ocean of arid land, and on an ordinary day on a lonely road with an unending blue sky, the patriarch Phil McBride swerves to avoid a kangaroo. And in seconds, the lives of the entire McBride family are shattered. And then tragedy revisits when a twist of consequences claims the life of another sibling and leads another to give up everything for the sake of an innocent child. The secrets at the heart of this gutting and beautiful story force Matt, the youngest McBride, to choose between love and duty, sacrifice and happiness. I loved A Far-Flung Life because it's about family and belonging and fate and time, but it's also about people trying their best and each, for private reasons, seeking shelter from the storm of life. ML Stedman doesn't grant interviews. She refuses, and if you Google her, you will find next to nothing of her personal info. She feels strongly that her work must speak for itself. And in our noisy world of social media, which seems to give you no choice but to engage, I think that that restraint is so admirable. And yes, her work does speak for itself. So far, through the pages, we've visited southern USA and western Australia. Have you read a book that's taken you somewhere? I would love to hear about it on 061-895-1019. After the break, we're going to hear more from Tan Thuan Eng. He is the multiple Booker Prize nominee and the author of The House of Doors. He was at the FLF and he had to contend with a very gushing fangirl in me raving about his newest book called The House of Doors. It's a magnificent, sophisticated novel based on real events that will whisk you and immerse you in 1920s Malaysia. So don't go away, but first an ad break.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. Today's show is all about immersive fiction, transporting stories that allow us to travel not just across geography, but across experience and culture and minds and moments that we would otherwise never encounter. A breathtaking work of fiction that made me feel like I had traveled to colonial Malaysia is a book called The House of Doors. It's a richly layered historical novel by Tan Thuan Eng, the multiple award-winning and Man Booker Prize shortlisted author for The Garden of Evening Mists, which I'm sure you would have read. And before that, The Gift of Rain. The Gift of Rain was kind of before my time, before I was reading books like this. So it's currently on my TBR pile, to be read pile. And I am both honored and delighted to have in my company, Ad Franchuk, Thuan Eng, as my guest today. A very warm welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Batya. It's really lovely to be talking to you and to be in Franchuk, where the weather is sunny and cool.
Which is no small thing, because the Franchuk Literary Festival this year, with the terrible rain and weather in Cape Town, there were threats that it was going to be cancelled. So we're all mightily relieved. But a little bit about The House of Doors, which is a spellbinding novel about love and betrayal, colonialism and revolution, storytelling and redemption. The year is 1921, and we meet Leslie Hamlin and her husband Robert, who's a lawyer and a war veteran. They are living in the Straits settlement of Penang, and his friend Willie Somerset Maugham, who is a famed writer and an old friend of Robert's, arrives for an extended visit with his secretary. We'll call him the secretary for now. And the pair threatens a rift that could alter more lives than just one. Maugham is one of the greatest novelists of the day, but his career is deflating. His health is failing, his finances are failing, and he arrives here in desperate need of a new story. I guess it's every writer's nightmare. Leslie, of course, is enduring a marriage that is less than perfect, and Maugham suspects an affair. Well, so does the reader, I guess. You're not quite sure with who. But you then learn of Leslie's past connection to the Chinese revolutionary, Dr. Sun Yat-sen, who... And they decide to probe further and get more of the story kind of revealed. But as their friendship grows and Leslie confides in him about life in the Straits, and I have to tell you, as a reader, you're reading it and you're thinking, Leslie, please don't tell him the story. Please don't tell him the story. He's going to write it. But I think she knows that. We'll talk more about that later. Sure. And Maugham discovers a surprising tale, more surprising than he imagined. It's not only about war and scandal, but the trial of an English woman charged with murder. It is, to Maugham, a story worthy of fiction. So reading this book transported me to 1920s Penang, and it introduced me to a country of which I know very little. I'm sure I'm not the only reader to feel that. You are a trailblazer in Malaysian and Southeast Asian writers and for the authors like that. Do you feel a weight of responsibility in representing the culture on a global stage?
I'm sure some people have tried to impose that burden on me, but I've always made it a point to evade that because I don't think I should be the one to, as you say, break open the boundaries. I've never seen myself as that. I basically see myself as a novelist, a writer, and my main duty is to improve as a writer with every book. So if you're going to read The Gift of Rain now, after you read my other two books, yes, you're going to see how I started out, because The Gift of Rain was my first novel, yes, and you'll see a lot of flaws of a beginning writer in that book, and hopefully you see the progression as well with each book.
Oh, I doubt I'll see flaws, but it is going to be interesting as a reader to kind of go back. Do you ever read your books again? It must be cringeworthy, I suppose.
It is. All I can see are the bad writing, yes, the bad writing, the flaws, the deficiencies. And I tell myself, why didn't I improve on this scene? Why couldn't I have written it in a different way? It's futile, but it's also a good learning experience for my next book, which I'm working on now, and I can tell myself that okay, I made a mistake there, so let's learn from that and do it differently in this
amazing
book.
Yeah. And I listening to your previous interviews, you take writing and rewriting very seriously.
I love rewriting. I love it. I love, I could spend years rewriting. I hate getting the first draft out because that's hard work. But once you've got that block there, a misshapen block, yes, but at least you have something to work with.
Yes,
you can chip
away. Craft.
Yes. And that I find that extremely enjoyable, frustrating, but enjoyable.
Of course.
Rewriting.
It's kind of meditative, actually.
It is. It's also, it can be quite self-indulgent as well. You know, it can become luxuriate in a lot of time wasting. Mm. Should I put the colon here? Should that be an M dash?
And no M dash anymore. With the world of AI, we don't do M dashes.
And you tend to become self-indulgent doing that. But I'm also aware when I'm rewriting, okay, how would this paragraph look? Not just read, but look on the page. So if the paragraph is too huge and chunky, it will look ungainly on a page.
Wow.
So the visual aspect of the manuscript itself, I'm quite aware of as well when I'm writing.
Well, I think you get a sense of the care taken. It's almost artisanal in the way it's crafted. And I think you get a sense of that as the reader. In this book, The House of Doors, you have fictional characters and you have real characters. And I would imagine that presented both opportunities and challenges. In fact, in the beginning, you quote Somerset Maugham in the book and you say, he said, "Fact and fiction are so intermingled in my work that now, looking back on it, I can hardly distinguish one from the other." Is that the same for you?
No, but it's the effect that I try to achieve in my writing. I'm very aware, because I used to be a lawyer, so I'm very aware of what's factual and what's fictional. But in my work, I try to blur everything into this reality that I want to convey to the reader. And I'm very glad you highlighted that epigraph, because we had to get permission from Somerset Maugham's literary estate rights holder.
Yes.
And it cost me, not the publisher, because Canongate didn't want to pay for it. So it cost me a lot of money.
Oh, well, I hope you...
Well,
now you've got your money's worth.
I was quite annoyed because
yes,
I told them, look, you know, this will help promote Somerset Maugham's titles.
Yes.
And they were obdurate, and they said, no, you have to pay for it.
Well, I am surprised because, and if I can be honest, I did not know Somerset Maugham's work. It was not taught to me at school, and I wasn't familiar with it, and I didn't do an English degree after school. So I think that it has widened the access to his work and publicized the work that he's done.
I think so. Not to sound egotistical, but I mean, he doesn't need more promotion. He's still well known in England and the UK. But for the rest of the world, he's become, you know, his fame has dimmed a bit.
Yes.
So I was quite pleased when about a year after The House of Doors came out, I had an email from Somerset Maugham's granddaughter.
Ah.
She emailed me. She's called Camilla.
Yes.
And she said, when you're next in London, come for tea.
Oh, lovely.
So I did. And they were happy with the book. They said, thank you for bringing my grandfather back into the public's awareness again.
Yes.
And it was quite an experience sitting in her sitting room in her flat in central London. And all her grandfather's books were around her. There were portraits of Somerset Maugham on the wall. It was quite surreal as well to sit there. Yes, yes.
I'm sure, especially because you have spent a lot of time with Somerset Maugham now.
Yes.
You've spent years with him,
yes,
writing
yes.
him.
Reading him.
Reading him yes. and writing yes. him. The House of Doors is based on true events. And one of the key events is a fascinating Malaysian murder case in 1911. Tell us about this historical case and what drew you to it.
Well, it's a well-known case because in 1910... the wife of a schoolmaster, she's called Ethel Proudlock, Mrs. Ethel Proudlock. She was charged with murdering a man who had shown up at her house when her husband was away in somewhere. And her defense was that this man, a friend of hers called William Stewart, had tried to rape her, and that's why she killed him. But the problem was that she shot him in the back when he was walking away. 6 times. The rumors were that she had been having an affair with William Stewart. So this was a cause célèbre in Kuala Lumpur in the 1900s.
Yes.
And she became a scarlet woman. She was accused of all sorts of things. She lost all her friends. She was basically cancelled in those days.
Yes.
They didn't want
yes.
to know about her. Even worse was that, I can't say much because then I'll give away
yes.
the story, but eventually she was asked to leave the country, and the English community said, we don't want you here.
Yeah.
Just go away.
Well, I think that I found that so fascinating, the inherent colonial attitudes and racism, I guess, inherent in this case, because the English are kind of embarrassed that she's let the side down.
Oh, yes.
And the sort of the rest of the community, the Malays are, I don't know, you don't actually hear, were they saying, oh, you see, a white woman
could do that too? They probably did, because I think a strong basis for English colonial rule in their colonies was that we are the moral superiors.
Mm. Mm.
We are here to show you uneducated natives that you know,
yes.
we know better, and we're here to uplift your souls. And then suddenly to show that, hey, to have an example, we're also human. We are prone to lust and anger and murderous urges. The whole basis of the foundation of their rule was severely weakened.
Yeah.
And this the English community did not like and could not accept.
I relate so strongly to this because, you know, whenever you see a headline of some really evil person, you think, oh God, you know, please let him not be Jewish
yes.
or please let him not be South African. You kind of take
yes.
on the reputation of
yes.
of a whole community, a whole
yes.
country, a whole nation.
Yes, you do, yes. Unfortunately, yes. But in a way, that forces us who are outside our own communities to be on our better behavior.
Yes, yes, maybe it keeps us in line.
Yeah. because as a Malaysian Chinese,
yes.
wherever I go outside Malaysia, I'm very aware that my actions, my words, even though I don't want them to be, they do reflect on my country.
Of course. And your culture, and your identity.
In a way, there are good points to that. It forces me to be aware that, okay, I have to be polite, I have to be considerate, which yes. I'm not sometimes.
Oh, I don't believe that.
it's double-edged sword.
Yes, it is. I would imagine you used all the historical references available to you, but there are voices that are not recorded in the historical record. And I would imagine that the historical record that we have access to is through a British colonial lens. How did you find the other voices to flesh out?
Well, I read a lot of memoirs and letters of Penang-born people, which unfortunately they were all in English. Because I can only
read English.
I can't read Chinese. So I can read Malay. I'm fluent in Malay.
And there are no records in Malay?
Not in the official archives. Mm. Not in the official. And getting to the official archives was a huge task as well. The archives of Malaysia. I wanted to look for the official transcripts of Ethel Proudlock's trial. I just couldn't find them.
Really?
Eventually, I
wonder if they were so-called lost.
No, I just think it was just bad record keeping, I suppose.
Yes.
Eventually, I found them in the archives in Kew, but that was too far for me to fly. So, to my delight, I also found them in Singapore's National Archives.
Wow. Yeah.
So I was in Kuala Lumpur.
And
so
I flew down in English.
And I flew down to the Singapore National Archives. And they were so professional and so friendly and so helpful. It was just unbelievable, yes.
Yeah, it's lovely. I think they're so delighted that someone has shown an interest in history.
No, they were just very professional.
Lovely.
Yes.
Lovely. Well, in the House of Doors, the smells and the sights of Penang are so evocative. And the book opened my eyes to a treasure trove of cultures, of fragrant fruit, of language I've never explored. I was introduced to the Straits Chinese, who I had never really heard of or thought about. The charismatic revolutionary, Dr. Sun Yat-sen. I heard about drinking stengas or eating mulligatawny soup. I felt like I was mingling with the memsahibs, or even hearing the music of the guzheng. And I had no idea that the plait, that is often you see images of boys and men with that plait,
yes,
down the middle of their heads. And I had no idea that it was more than just a cultural reference. There is a scene that is so moving in the book. I'd like to read from it. And the setting is that the Qing dynasty is dead. President Sun Yat-sen, who was actually the person who established the Republic of China, I had no idea. But the Republic of China has been established. There are celebrations in the streets, there are festivities, there are people standing on soapboxes giving speeches. And this is the scene. As I emerged onto Victoria Street, my eyes fell upon a line of Chinese coolies at an open-air Indian barber in a back alley. Curious, I stopped to watch them. One after another of the men perched themselves on the barber's high stool. The barber pegged a sheet of newspaper around their shoulders and proceeded to snip their braid off. Without fail, every one of the coolies rubbed the back of their head with their palm when they got off the stool. Some of them picked up their severed plait from the ground, coiling it around their wrist or stuffing it in their pocket. But there were also a great number of them who left their cords of hair lying on the ground where they had fallen. Many of the coolies had tears running down their cheeks. Whether from joy or sorrow, I could not tell. Tell us more about that.
The plate, or the queue, they call it, was a symbol of the Manchu oppression, because the Manchus were northern foreigners who conquered China and took over from the Ming Dynasty in the 1400s, I believe. They had a sort of different culture. You see, the problem is when people look at China, especially foreigners, they think it's a homogenous
yes.
country, but it's actually, you have to view China as sort of Europe. different countries on this mass continent, and different provinces of China are really like different countries. They have their own languages, their own cultures. The only thing that unifies them is the writing system, which is similar. It's exactly the same, but the way the words are pronounced different in each province, sometimes so strikingly different that you can't even tell what they're talking about. So the Manchus came, they took over the dynasty, they established their rule from the 1400s to the start of republicanism. And one of the symbols they imposed on all Chinese people was they had to shave the front of their foreheads and then grow the hair long into a braid and tie it down there. So it's a symbol of oppression, it's a symbol of control. So when Dr. Sun Yat-sen founded the Republic of China, he said, you can cut it off. We are no longer slaves of the Manchus. We are free people. So
it's a very powerful and beautiful symbol, actually.
Yes.
And I think a sort of slave being set free, I don't know if you cry from sorrow or joy. It's a mixed feeling.
It's a mix because the future is uncertain now, isn't it?
Yes.
What do I do next now that I'm free? What does that mean? Where can I go?
Yeah.
I'm frightened. I'm exhilarated, but I'm also frightened because it's the uncertainty. The certainty is gone. It was a very emotional time for a lot of the Chinese people everywhere in the world. They had to wear by law. Otherwise, they would be executed. Yes. But you see, the great thing about being in the Straits settlement was because it was under British control, and hence the Straits Chinese who emigrated from China, southern China, to the colonies, the British colonies, they were more free. And a lot of them adopted English and Malay cultures, assimilated the cultures into their lifestyle. So they spoke English and Malay at home, they wore Western clothing, they kept their hair short. So you have this contrast on this island where there's so many different types of people mingling around.
Fascinating. And as you say, it's so not homogenous.
Yes, it's not.
You know, Africa is not a country.
No,
it's the
not.
Same idea.
It's the same, yes.
It's the same idea. There are so many rich details. There's lyrical writing. It's an unforgettable story. I hope I have given you a sense of how immersive and transportive Tuan's writing is. The House of Doors is based on real events. It traces fault lines of race, of gender, of sexuality, and it dives into the complicated nature of love and friendship. It is a magnificent book for reading now or saving for a holiday when you really have time to savor every word. Tuan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. Today, with rich and immersive stories, we have touched on three continents. So now let's come home to South Africa, to the Karoo, with Sally Andrews' book, Wild Things Never Die. Tani Maria has become an icon. An icon character, and she's Sally Andrews' Karoo agony aunt and amateur sleuth, and her character and her recipes have achieved world international recognition. She, yes, the fictitious Tani Maria, even received a Gourmand Award for her cookbook Recipes to Die For, and Sally went along to pick it up for her in Portugal. And her new book adds to the collection and certainly delivers on the Tani Maria promise. It's called Wild Things Never Die, and this time Tani Maria is wrestling with a fear of the dark, and Henrietta, that's her hen, has PTSD. But it doesn't stop the intrepid agony aunt and her hen from going undercover with her fiancé, Detective Henk Kannemeyer, to the Karoo Wilderness Reserve. Their mission is to save the vet blinkies. And at this luxury game lodge, they spy on guests and they support the anti-poaching unit in a battle against dangerous gangsters. Jesse attends a succulent symposium, which is tackling the poaching problem internationally. And then there's a murder. So this is our favorite Ladysmith sleuths engaging with some colorful suspects, including a barefoot artist, a botanist cowboy, a singing gardener, and a sangoma. Between solving murders, writing agony aunt letters and eating spectacular food and having spiritual epiphanies, Maria and Henk also get fashion tips from a couturier and his baroness, who are two of the guests at the lodge. But of course, fashion is forgotten when their lives are at stake. Sally Andrews' books brim with true South African personality and humor and recipes, some of which I tried. I even made the coriander pesto, Moroccan pesto chicken the other night, which was delicious. And if you know Sally Andrew herself, you will get a sense that her quirkiness seeps through in her recipes, in her writing, in her characters. To give you a bit of a feel for Tani Maria, if you have not yet met her, this gives you an idea. They're talking about sleeveless dresses. She's getting that fashion advice that I mentioned. And Rodney is saying to Frida, no, you can't wear sleeveless. We need to face up to the fact that some of us get older and wider, not to mention the achternaweier. What is this word? Is it Afrikaans? Frida asks. We don't have that in German. Achternaweier. It means afterwards wavers. When you wave with your hand, and then this part, you know, that loose bit of muscle hanging from your upper arm, carries on flapping afterwards. Our meals were now on the table. I studied my two small dishes, both prettily arranged, lamb with tahini and yogurt sauce, and then a chicken sassati with Moroccan pesto. So, said Rodney, turning to face me, we have a few solutions for you. And on it goes. So it's a lot of fun. The other thing I found so fascinating was throughout the book, she is making a sourdough, some sourdough bread. And sourdough has become all the rage. We you know, you go to the restaurants, the bakeries, Friday afternoon, you know, you go and get your sourdough for the weekend ahead. And it's so on trend that even Tani Maria is trying to make her sourdough, and it's incredibly hard. You keep sort of folding it backwards and forwards and then waiting an hour and folding it backwards and forwards again. And I did enjoy Tani Maria's take on this actually quite arduous process. So if you haven't enjoyed Tani Maria before, the series is called Recipes for Love and Murder. After that came The Satanic Mechanic, then Death in the Limpopo, and then The Milk Tart Murders, and of course her recipe book. Also, if you scroll back a little bit to the podcasts, the Bookmark podcasts, and you go to the one called An Ode to the Kruger, A Bookish Ode to the Kruger, I interviewed Sally Andrew in that episode. She is a complete delight. And in fact, she was sitting on her stoop in the Karoo, which is where she lives. And the bulbuls, the birds, kept dropping in and saying hi to her. So she spent half the interview talking to the bulbuls. And I had to keep reminding her that we had an audience to actually talk to. So, yeah, she's a delight. Listen to that interview if you can. But either way, get Wild Things Never Die, the Tani Maria new mystery by Sally Andrew.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. This is Chai FM's Bookmark, and I'm Batya Bricker, talking about the stories that have transported us, taken us places through the pages. You've asked me for it, and so from now on, I will be recapping the books that we discuss in the show. I know some of you missed the beginning and then desperately scrambling for titles from the start. So today, we traveled to Western Australia with A Far-Flung Life by M.L. Stedman. We visited Mississippi in America's South with The Calamity Club and Catherine Stockett's new book. We popped into the Karoo, the arid Karoo, closer to home with Sally Andrew and Wild Things Never Die. And we had a good long chat with Tan Tuan Eng, who's the author of The House of Doors and who took us to Malaysia. This is Armchair Travel at its best, and I hope you've enjoyed the ride. There was no passport required, no visa, no security, none of that. Just fabulous reading. So in keeping with this theme, there are some countries that feel less like places and more like worlds unto themselves. And I think India is one such place. It's a country of extraordinary contrasts and staggering diversity. It contains multitudes of ancient and modern and sacred and chaotic, familiar and utterly foreign. It's a place where history lives alongside innovation and centuries-old traditions continue to shape daily life. Every region offers its own language, its own cuisine, its own customs and stories. So next week on Bookmark, we're going to be taking a deep dive into this remarkable country and its enduring legacy. We'll explore India's rich cultural heritage. We'll immerse ourselves in stories of its people, explore its influence on South Africa through its food and culture and society. And I'll also be chatting to Alka Joshi, who is the best-selling author of the Jaipur trilogy. You are probably familiar with The Henna Artist and the two books that came after that. And now, most recently, her book called 6 Days in Bombay. We'll have a deep dive into that book and talk a lot about the context and what inspired that story. So don't miss it. Until then, I wish you goodbye and very happy reading.